for Mr. O'Neill. Thank you. This may seem a little bit weird, but it'll be okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Menas. I'm Sean O'Neill. I'm with Gewirtz, Menasche, Larson & Howe. I'm a family lawyer. I'm also a member of the Executive Committee for the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, and also the chair of their vice chair of their legislative liaison committee, and on their committee right now, but I'm not appearing in that capacity. I've provided written testimony today, as well as testimony from my senior partner, William Howe, and I'm willing just really to rely on that testimony. This is a consensus bill. It's essentially a fix-up bill addressing an issue that arose by an Oregon Supreme Court case, Weber v. Olson, which essentially is saying that parties to family law matters cannot lose their contractual rights once a judgment, a final decree is signed. And this bill allows the parties to retain those rights and gives them a method to enforce settlement agreements if someone is to breach. I'm willing to entertain any questions.
I don't have any questions.
Okay.
And I understand you have another commitment in Portland?
That's correct.
Right. Okay. And I don't foresee that there'll be any difficulty moving the bill. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. All righty then. All right, the next bill is House Bill, Public Hearing House Bill 2201. Thank you, committee members, for helping. Now we're a full committee. At least we have a quorum.
We apologize, Mr. Chair.
Ken Kendall. And we've got 2201 and 2202 are virtually the same, but dealing with two different entities. So why don't we go ahead and take testimony on both of those?
Chair Menas, members of the committee, my name is Ken Cudell. I'm the administrator of both the Construction Contractors Board and the Landscape Contractors Board. Both of these boards are policy boards. Both strongly support these bills, these two bills that you have before you. We haven't appeared before this committee and probably won't on any other bill that we're aware of. There have been something close to 30 bills that would mend 701 that have been introduced. Those that have had hearings have gone before the Senate Business, Labor, and Economic Development Committee other than these bills. Again, I've been the administrator of the board since 1983. For most of that period of time, we've recognized that the best way to resolve a dispute that can't be resolved through negotiation or mediation would be arbitration. However, statute when it was created in 1971, basically sets forth the method of resolving that dispute to be a contested case hearing. What these bills would do is to say that unless the parties want a contested case hearing, or unless either of the parties want a contested case hearing, unless either of the parties want to take the issue to court, the board would resolve the dispute through binding arbitration. And that both parties will retain the right to go to court, both parties will retain the right to have it resolved through an administrative hearing. Bill Boyd is the manager of our claims division, and Bill is going to speak to the particulars of both of these bills, if you please.
Okay. By the way, I'm trying to remind myself, when did arbitration become a big deal here in Oregon?
Bill, do you recall?
I don't know. I think it's been around since the 30s. It's been just and used more a few years ago. The
wasn't there a task force that Jake Tanzer was engaged in or involved in?
Well, I don't know. It may have created the court mandated arbitration procedures that we have now. They aren't that old.
Trying to click my memory back, it seems to me that in the 89 Judiciary Committee did some stuff as a result of a study that I think Jake Tanzer was involved in. It kind of got a lot of this going within the court system, large extent.
You authorized the board to legislation several sessions ago to require mandatory arbitration on cases where the claim is less than $1,000. We've been doing that for several years, and it works very well. It's faster, and it just works better decisions.
Bill. All right. My name is Bill Boyd. I'm the manager of the Claims Resolution Section for the Construction Contractors Board. I'm also a member of the State Bar and the chair of my local Bar Association Alternate Dispute Resolution Committee, although I'm here only speaking as the manager of the CCB. Every time that we've testified on this bill, Ken has got up and spoken and usually stolen about half of the material out of my prepared testimony, so I have to go through and edit it as I go along. The CCB handles disputes between contractors and their customers, and also between contractors and certain people that contract with them. And we, the areas that we deal with or that we have authority to deal with are breach of contract and negligent or improper work, essentially the same kind of jurisdiction a circuit court would have over a breach of contract case. We get about 5,000 claims a year. About 500 of those have to be resolved through some sort of a hearing. Today, those hearings are held as contested cases. As Ken mentioned, cases where the claim is for $1,000 or less go to arbitration, and also cases where the parties agree to arbitrate the case are arbitrated. We believe that if we set up the program today, that we would go ahead and use arbitration as sort of the default procedure for resolving the cases. But and the reason that we feel strongly about that is that...
Okay, hang on a second. Work session.
Chair, I move House Bill 2202 being goes to the Senate House...
2201
to the Senate floor to do pass recommendations.
Senate recording goes 22. House Bill 2201 to floor. Senate to do pass recommendations. Discussion? Any objections?
We're done.
And Senator Courtney will carry this. Public hearing 2202. It's the same thing you just said.
Mr. Chair.
Work session 22.
Chairman of House Bill 2202 be engrossed in the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2202 be engrossed in the floor of the Senate to do pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections?
Thank you very much.
An old attorney once said that when you win, you get up and leave.
That's a good philosophy.
We're back on time, y'all.
All right, let's... No one? Go back to 2494, and this is a work session. Andrea, if you would explain what this bill does again.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2494 is basically a fix that responds to a Supreme Court case, Weber versus Olson, in which the Supreme Court held that stipulated judgments of dissolution of marriage or divorces cannot be enforceable as contracts, and that the parties are limited to enforcement of judgments through equitable means by contempt or through garnishment. And so what that means is that if you have a stipulated agreement, an agreement that both sides agree to for a divorce, you can't get contract remedies. And the issue that has come up is that, first of all, probably at least 45% of divorces that are done without lawyers. Another 45% of the divorces that are done with one attorney. And so it's only 10% of the divorces that have two attorneys. This decision in Weber v. Olson is really technical in terms of how people can enforce their rights within a divorce case. And a lot of times people, when they're divorcing, they make agreements that are contractual type agreements. If you'll do this, I'll pay for this, if those kind of things. And they give up certain probably property rights or different things that they could have argued about because They believe that in the future, they'll be able to, if they have to, they could go sue to gain what the person basically contracted to in the dissolution. So what this bill does is it makes it clear that parties can enforce those rights through contracts. And in the House side, we had probably a good 45 minutes worth of testimony from family law practitioners saying how important this was and how many people out in the public are getting divorced thinking that they have protected their rights when in fact they haven't. And it's only probably the very best and most well-informed practitioners of family law that are doing these statements or these documents correctly.
All right. Questions? The House amendments were apparently to just put a policy statement or preamble type document into.
Well, they also made some changes that the Judicial Department was concerned that the new language might be interpreted to allow for jury trials in the contract aspect of divorce cases. And so the House changes just clarify that that's not the case. It's just that the court, the judge, can make a decision in, based on contract, not just equitable remedies.
All right, so explain the equitable remedies issue. If I had gone through one of these, I wanted to enforce part of what I thought was a contract now, how would I have to proceed?
Well, if you wanted to do it, there is a way that you can do the documents now that would give you contract rights. And I don't know technically enough what that's called, but as far as enforcing the contract aspect, you wouldn't be able to do that. The only thing that the court could do would have options such as garnishment or contempt of court.
All right. And by passing this bill, it'll provide for what methodology for enforcement. Again, contract law would apply.
Contract law would apply, and so the judge can enforce the contract when making it.
So the action would be, if I wanted to enforce part of this contract, what would I do? Would I file a motion with the court to do?
Right, you could file a lawsuit.
Okay, so I file suit. And this just makes it clear that contract law applies, and the judge can then enforce
yes.
that contract.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Peter, are you ready?
I'm ready to go.
All right. We're in work session, by the
way. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2494 A and goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Courtney moves. House Bill 2494 A and goes to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And any volunteers?
Not a chance.
I'll carry it.
To the best of my ability.
For which one?
For the other two.
Yes, Senator Courtney.
Okay, thank you.
And Andrea will be by my side.
And I'll get Mr. O'Neill to write the talking point.
Good idea. Let's do the work session on 2386, if we could. This is a bill that we had a public hearing on a while back, and the issue was relevant to garnishments. The issue that came up was the notice that was filed on behalf of the state to individuals when they were going to collect. And I think I asked a whole bunch of questions and asked them to clarify some of the procedures so we have amendments.
Great. Okay. Maybe we could have a single, Mr. Hendricks.
Sure.
Mr. Hendricks, could you come up?
You're going to have to speak loud. We've got a back noise here.
Chair Minutes, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel's Office. The questions at the last hearing were about the specific nature of the hearing that would be afforded to a debtor who received one of these agencies' notice of garnishment, and when the debtor wanted to come in and assert that some of the property was exempt from garnishment or not subject to garnishment. Randy Jordan of DOJ went back to the agencies that perform this sort of, use these sort of notices and check with them. There were various different ways that they currently do it, but the decision was for simplicity and because of the fairly low number of such cases that come up, that they would simply give them a contested case hearing, which is a full, the full hearing that you receive under the Administrative Procedures Act, the same sort of hearing you get if they want to take your license or do any of the other bad things that an agency can do to you. So this is a pretty full protections for that person. And they've also indicated that they would send these hearings over to the hearings officer panel. Assuming that it's still in existence after next year when it has, or next session when it has the sunset on it, they will continue to do that. So that this, I think, pretty much responds to the question about what type of hearing was going to be afforded to the debtor in these cases.
All right, those are the A4 amendments?
Yes, Senator Mendoza.
Okay.
They've made a part of the bill and not. Excuse me, I'm sure. We work session.
Yeah.
No, we are in work session. I'm sorry.
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move that the dash four amendments to House Bill 2386 be
approved. All right, Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the dash four amendments to House Bill 2386 and engrossed. Discussion. Andrea, would you explain, if you're looking at the amendments, by the way, there's a section on page 3 talking about when the amendments become operative and so forth. If you have a question about that, Andrea, can you explain it to us?
Okay. If you see on page 3, the very last thing, it says the amendments to Section 82 of this 2001 Act by Section 82A become operative January 1st. 2004, and that deals with the sunsetting of the Central Hearings Panel. So that's just alternate language. If the Hearings Panel, Central Hearings Panel, does go away, then this law would have language in place to deal with that.
Okay. Any discussion, questions? Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2386. As amended to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation.
And Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2386 as amended for the Senate with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. Order. And any volunteers?
Not on your own.
I'll do anything they won't do, I'll do, because they call me workhorse plowhorse.
Workhorse plowhorse.
I'm one of the two people on the committee to understand that you do that.
Andrew, you're going to sit with me. You'll be with me.
Yes, I will be with you.
She'll sit with you.
I sat with you the other day.
Not really. You were there, but you weren't there.
You didn't need any help. You were on fire.
We thought it was all wet. All right, public hearing, House Bill 2375. Mr. Jeff Johnson.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Johnson. I'm an attorney in Portland. I've been practicing for 19 years, and I'm currently secretary of the Oregon State Bar's Procedure and Practice Committee, and I'm testifying on behalf of House Bill 2375. For those of you who are not familiar with our committee, the Procedure and Practice Committee is composed of attorneys throughout the state. The committee is evenly balanced between attorneys who represent defendants and those who primarily represent plaintiffs in civil litigation. Members of the committee attempt to use their experience and knowledge to enhance the effectiveness of the civil justice system and not on behalf of any particular client or particular cause. It is in this context that the committee proposed HB 2375, which proposes to amend ORS 45250 sub 2C. This bill was submitted to solve a problem created in an appellate court case called Graham versus Bricks Maritime. It involves the use of a deposition testimony when a witness is not available for trial. Very briefly, the context is this. In that Bricks case, the plaintiff was injured while working on a boat based out of Oregon. The witness, who was the captain of the boat and was employed by the defendant, resided in the state of Washington. He was deposed but not served with a subpoena for trial at his deposition. Then at trial, the defendant did not produce the captain to testify, and the witness was outside the jurisdiction of the Oregon court. So the plaintiffs attempted to offer the deposition testimony at trial under ORS 45-250. The Court of Appeals upheld the trial court's decision to not allow that testimony because the attorney who was taking the deposition had the opportunity to serve a subpoena at the deposition but failed to do so. You are permitted to use deposition testimony in lieu of live testimony if you meet certain criteria. You can't be lazy. You have to make a good faith diligent effort to try to procure the attendance of the witness to get that live testimony before you can use deposition testimony. Unfortunately, at the time of the deposition, the trial date was not known, and so the plaintiff's attorney did not serve that witness with a subpoena. What this bill has attempted to do is to simply say that the mere fact that you didn't carry a subpoena in your briefcase when you took a deposition is not in and of itself sufficient to preclude you from being able to use that deposition testimony at trial. The litigant will still need to go through the various hoops to establish unavailability, but that the mere fact that you don't carry a subpoena with you is not going to be dispositive. And the reason that's important and to the legal system is that, excuse me, with our trial docket as it is, you oftentimes take depositions and you either do not have a trial date because of the way the courts structure their docket. Or, for example, in Multnomah County, we may have a trial date, but we do not know whether that case is going to go out on the date scheduled. So you have the problem of telling a witness that may be just a lay witness who may have to travel some distance to come on a certain date on a deposition on the subpoena, but they're in fact not going to actually have to appear. And so you have added costs and you have inconvenience to lay witnesses. And so this bill, we think, is a very simple solution to this problem. Any questions?
Well, now, just to kind of try to this limits it to at the time of deposition.
That's correct.
Is that correct? So what happens after deposition and then trial comes up? Is the attorney required, if they want that person to appear in person at trial, they assume they have to serve them a subpoena?
That is correct.
Get them there.
That is correct. However, Chairman, the practical reality in the Bricks case is that if the witness is an out-of-state resident, in this case, a Washington resident, that person is outside the subpoena power of the plaintiff, even though the witness is an employee of the defendant. You still can't physically require them to cross the state line. So then there are other things that we can do. We could go out of state, and we could get the Washington court to issue a subpoena to compel that witness to appear for a perpetuation deposition, and we could videotape or take that testimony for purposes of introduction at trial by way of perpetuation. There are steps that you can go through, but that's how it works.
And I'm assuming you'll have to explain that to the judge.
Absolutely.
That particular individual is not available for the following reasons.
The bill is not designed to reward laziness, but there is the real practical reality here in the way the system works.
All right. Any questions? Next session.
Chair, I move House Bill 2375 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2375 to the floor of Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none. Oh, let me see. Senator Metzger, would you carry this bill?
Oh, sir.
You doing okay today?
Huh?
You look like you're getting better.
I'm getting a little better.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Still looks pretty ugly to me.
What's that?
You say he still looks pretty ugly to you.
I think you say what he said.
Sir, he said he looks ugly.
Commenting about his physical health.
A tough room here.
All right, before this gets too out of control, public hearing, House Bill 2665.
And I don't believe anyone signed up for 2665. I can tell you what it does, though.
Why don't you?
All right. House Bill 2665 is a really simple bill that just exempts certain non-substantive, famous last words, right? Administrative rule modifications from notice and hearing requirements. The background of this bill is actually a lobbyist was at an OLCC hearing and saw them go through the whole formal Administrative Procedures Act formal hearing process in order to change some, I believe it was spelling mistakes or punctuation errors in the administrative rules for the OLCC. And the lobbyist thought that was kind of ridiculous and so proposed this legislation that was then sponsored by Representative Williams in the House. And in the House, we had a discussion about the bill. There were some concerns with the language as it was originally written because a non that dealt with grammar changes, and that's because to one person certain grammar changes might be substantive and to another they might not, and rather than give any sort of wiggle room in terms of the possibility that the agency would change rules that could change the or affect the rights of the citizens, the language was narrowed considerably to just deal with things like spelling errors and those kind of things. That if a name changes of another agency, those kind of things. So that's what it does.
Does this this doesn't allow for substituting different words, does it?
Well, I believe, I recall. That it deals with, I think if it, like the name of the agency or something changes.
I guess line 25 of page 3 would probably cover correcting grammatical mistakes in a manner that does not alter the scope, application,
right,
or meaning.
And that was the the wording that we amended in the House to so that it's clear that you can't change what it means, just how it's written.
All righty, work session. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2665A and goes to the session of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves. House Bill 2665A and goes to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none.
I can do this one.
You can do this one.
I can
do Harper will carry this one. Yeah. I can do this one.
Don't mess it up.
You let me know if you want me to be aware of it.
Right up there with water fountains, Senator.
2667. Public hearing. Dan Hunt. I know, we're fast around here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Nan Heim, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Rehabilitation Association in support of House Bill 2667. Our association is made up of 80 nonprofit programs all over the state that provide jobs and housing to more than 5,000 adult Oregonians with developmental disabilities, mainly mental retardation and usually multiple physical disabilities as well. Many of the people we serve have previously been at Fairview. House Bill 2667 removes the sunset on a law that was enacted 4 years ago. As you remember, Mr. Chair, it went through the House Judiciary Committee when you were the chair. It extends the state's tort liability limitations to some but not all of our programs. It applies only to those programs that are most directly doing the work of the state, where at least half of the people served at the program have been at Fairview, and at least half of the program's revenue comes from the state. There, we had two purposes in seeking the original bill. One was to help control escalating insurance costs for our program, and two was to help reassure our programs as Fairview closed that they would not be incurring unmanageable liability risks. We think that the law has been successful in both purposes, and it's an important tool to help our programs do their work. We are not the only programs that have this. Children's programs also do. And with that, I encourage your support.
Any questions? Work session,
2667. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2667, Senate floor due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2667, the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendations. Any discussion?
I'd like to carry you.
Yes, sir. Any objections? Hearing none.
I will see you in order.
Duncan. Oh, yeah. Hero Bill. You'll carry this one, Hero Bill.
I'm doing it for Nan.
Oh, here we go. Co-carriers now.
Burdick wants to carry it too.
Who? Senator Burdick? Why don't they all carry it?
We all like Nan.
President has 1.3 minutes to speak.
Public hearing
29. Somebody gets people biting over to carry your bill. I won, Nan.
Ed, how are you today?
Chairman, it's good to see you again. Members of the committee, my name is Ed Harnden. I'm president of the Oregon State Bar and practice in Portland, Oregon. It's a pleasure to be here. I've just finished a trial at about 1 minute till 12. I wasn't sure I would make it. I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 2938. This is what I consider to be a very easy solution to part of a problem we have in terms of funding legal services for low-income individuals in Oregon. We have a major shortfall in the ability to provide that funding. What this bill does is to provide for a fee for lawyers from out of state to come into the state on a pro hoc vici basis to handle matters in the state. Approximately 14 other states have a similar charge where lawyers go from one state to the other. This fee would be paid to the, or would allow the Oregon Supreme Court to have this fee paid to the Oregon State Bar, and it would be handled through a program that the legislature set up in 1997, which has been working extremely well. And I'm actually proud to let you know that Oregon, the Oregon State Bar, and the legislature, having set this up, has received the Harrison Tweed Award, I just found out last night, for our work to make sure that legal services are handled in an efficient manner and in a manner which gets things done at the lowest cost possible, as well as doing it very well. It does one other thing, and that is it allows us to track the lawyers that are coming into the state to practice, which is very important. Presently, we don't really have that capability, or at least it's not being done very effectively. This would allow us to track those lawyers coming in to more effectively and better check what they're doing, and perhaps most importantly, to make sure that our discipline system is applying to those lawyers and is a better discipline system that protects the public. The bill passed by 43-3 in the House. I would ask your support. I think it's a good bill for the citizens.
Senator Courtney.
Mr. President.
Yes.
Laws like this exist in other states?
Yes. Chairman, Vice Chair Courtney, they do. It's, I believe the number is 14 states. I will not be able to give you all of the states.
I'm not embarrassed to put you on the spot, Mr. President. I just could you tell me if they're nearby states?
Actually, all of us have to have our help. I can't. I can get you that information very readily. I know that it's not. It's used very regularly. And it's used for almost always for situations where the money is used for low income. But more importantly, it gives all those states the ability to track those lawyers and to discipline them. I consider it a fairness bill to all the attorneys in the other states that we will be able to help them charge us and we'll charge them. So it would be fair for them.
Chairman Minnis, Vice Chair, Senator Courtney, my name is Karen Garza. I'm the Executive Director of the State Bar. There are 13 states in the District of Columbia that charge a current fee, and the states are Alabama, Alaska, California, Delaware, Hawaii, Idaho, Indiana, Montana, Nevada, North Dakota, my home state, South Dakota, South Carolina, Utah, Washington, D.C. is the other jurisdiction, and West Virginia. So most of the states surrounding Oregon are part of that.
Thank you very much. Senator Metzger.
I just have a question. Do you have any idea of what, in terms of the fee generation based on the experience of attorneys who come to Oregon, that this might generate in terms of what, for assistance for low-income legal services? I'm just curious as to what type of impact this might have.
Chairman Minnis and Senator Metzger, because our system currently is very difficult to keep track of, I'm going to just we'll give you a ballpark, and we feel that it would might generate up to $200,000 a year. One of the reasons that the Oregon Supreme Court supports this effort is because we don't really have a good system for keeping track of who comes in. So I would be happy to come back and have indicated to, you know, report next session or possibly to the committees on an interim as we get it set up. But that it's a real guess on my part.
What is your current in terms of what is the current budgeting for the bar for a low-income legal services now on an annual basis? How many dollars do you have available for that channel?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Gromesker, what we do is we are, and this was set up by the legislature in 1997, is the filing fees that are generated by the counties used to go directly to the legal aid programs. And in 1997, when there was about $1 million increase per year in those fees, the legislature wanted them to go through us so we could evaluate the programs. And I'm going to turn around, and the head of the legal aid services is here. I think it's three a year. About $3 million a year from filing fees passed through our system for that purpose.
Generate 7-8% more for that, out of that.
All right, thanks.
Sure. Senator
Harper. What exactly is the problem? I've heard a couple of things brought out.
Okay, Chairman, Senator Harper, there are two issues here. One is the fees would go towards the providing legal services to low income. And the problem there is we have a shortfall of somewhere around $10 million in providing those services. And this would simply help close that gap on that shortfall.
So this would supply $200,000 toward a $10 million shortfall.
Exactly.
Feel better already.
It's not going to get us there. I should say that the things like the campaign for equal justice, which raises approximately $700,000 from the lawyers of the state, goes into that. There's a whole number of things that are being done to try to close that gap. This is one of them.
Why wouldn't we just raise the fees for the lawyers in the state to help close that gap?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Harper, the $10 million we identified after we did a study last spring of low-income Oregonians, we found that we're meeting 20% of their legal needs. And we came up with a multifaceted solution to that that starts at the federal level. And Senator Gordon Smith and Senator Ron Wyden have pledged to work with us on enhancing those funds because they've been pretty much level for the last 20 years for legal aid. In addition, there's about $750,000 we get from attorneys that they give voluntarily, and that has gone up about $100,000 a year, and we're going to continue to work to get that voluntarily. Currently, there are no the funds that the members in Oregon, which is a mandatory state, they have to be part of the bar. They pay $416 a year, and that goes to our discipline system, our admission system, et cetera. None of that goes directly to legal aid. We have also tried this session to try to, it's our first session here, but to try to get some general fund. There are 24 states that provide general fund for legal aid, and Oregon does not. Obviously not the best session to be coming asking for general fund, but there are the other thing that we'll probably be looking at the next session is raising filing fees, but because we raised them in 97 and that raising filing fees also has an impact on people's access to the system, we wanted to wait another session before we did that.
The low-income legal services is one, and the second was tracking these people?
Yes, Chairman and Senator Harper. The second is to track the lawyers that are practicing in the state. Presently, there's not a very comprehensive way of tracking those lawyers. that are coming in on a pro hoc vici basis. So we can do several things. One is to check to make sure they're practicing appropriately in the state, as we do with all lawyers who are licensed to practice in Oregon. And as a part of that is, you know, the ultimate end to making sure they're practicing well is the discipline end, and making sure that if discipline coming out of the checking is necessary, that we're able to handle that in a more comprehensive manner.
Can't you just have them sign in when they get to the court? Why do you have to charge a fee?
Well, we can do that. Certainly, Chairman and Senator Harper, one of the ways in order to make sure they're checking in is to pay the fee that Oregon lawyers pay, or a portion of it, as they come in to check. Part of the fees the Oregon lawyers pay is for the discipline process and for the checking process to make sure it's working well. So this would be a part of their paying their way as that process.
And Chairman Minnis, Senator Harper, that's really kind of a secondary benefit. What we were doing, we're working with some of the legislators, particularly in the House Judiciary, Representative Patridge and Shetterly and Williams, to try to come up with a creative way of finding at least something this session to be able to close that gap. So because other states were doing it, we thought it was a viable funding source to look at. A secondary benefit will be to have a better tracking system than we currently have.
Last question, Mr. Chair. And is it going to be $250, or what will it be?
Chairman Minnis, Senator Harper, we have talked with the Supreme Court about starting it at $250, and that's what we've tentatively agreed to. Currently, our dues are $416, so it's considerably less than that. The closest state to us, Nevada, is charging $350, which are their bar dues, but we felt it was more appropriate to charge less than our annual bar dues.
But that's not in statute any place.
Chairman Minnis, Senator Harper, that would be by rule of the Oregon Supreme Court.
Thank you.
Okay, and I have a question. How are we going to account for the money? There's no budgetary, or there's no referral to Ways and Means. It's
right.
Passing through the Judicial Department to the Oregon State Bar.
Senator Minnis, the Legislative Fiscal Office said because it's not appropriated to the, that they don't, they didn't need the bill in Ways and Means, and it's very similar to admission fees. The statute allows the Oregon Supreme Court to make it mandatory that lawyers take a bar exam, for example, and it allows the Supreme Court to set that fee, and then that fee comes to the Oregon State Bar on contract with the Oregon Supreme Court. So this is very similar to that process.
But is that because it's a pass-through? It seems to me that they should have an other funds limitation or something.
Well, Chairman Minnis, Legislative Fiscal, and Robin Lamont explained this to us. Because it's not going to the Oregon Supreme Court, they didn't feel it was necessary to have it come through Legislative Fiscal. The admission fee, for example, or the bar dues does not go through the Oregon Supreme Court or the Oregon Judicial Department, so it would be treated similar to
and
that.
They don't have a limitation, another funds limitation in the
That's
Judicial
correct.
Department for those fees?
That's correct.
I would add, Chairman Minnis, that the program that was set up in 1997, we track that very carefully as it's going through and providing those legal services, and we'd be happy to provide that information, but everything that comes into that program is tracked and reported penny for penny.
I assume it's public record.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Do a little work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2938 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2938 to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Beyer, are you?
I'm a no.
There's a no. Any other no votes?
Mr. Chairman?
Sorry.
I wish to declare a potential conflict of interest because I've done work for a subsidiary of the bar and I've had a consulting business.
All right, so you're not a no vote. You're just declaring a potential conflict of interest. Senator Harper also shows as a no.
Either taxing lawyers. Why are you voting no for?
Taxing out-of-state lawyers.
Yeah, he's better. All right, two dissenting votes. Yes, sir.
Maybe we could offer some little minority report that would eliminate the state law.
Oh. Vote
pass. We're adjourned. We have till 5 o'clock.